Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for readers, writers and nosy people. I'm your host, Daisy Buchanan, and in this week's episode I'm talking to one of my favourite writers and one of my favourite people, Kathy Rensenbrink. Lots of people will know Kathy's work from her best-selling memoir, The Last Act of Love. Kathy is one of the wisest people I've ever met. We first became friends a few years ago. I think that there's nothing she doesn't know about. She's an emotional genius. She's also one of my favourite people to talk about books to. We went to visit her in Falmouth in Cornwall. It's my first time in Falmouth. Together, we talked about book abuse and very battered, tatty covers, lending, reading in the bath, what you read in bed before you go to sleep, and prison. So I wanted to ask, before we came, did you do much kind of curation or tidying? Did you... When you looked at your books and how they were, did you think this reflects well on me? Did you think, oh, I'd quite like them not to know?
Do I consider my bookshelf cases to say things about me? I think that's a very interesting subject. I mean, I might have done if they were in better nick, whereas mainly what I did was take a few more things out, a few more boxes, because although we moved house a year ago, I'm still in some disarray with the books. What I do like to spend quite a lot of time doing is rearranging my books, you know, putting them in alphabetical order. Theming them, I'll try different things. I'll try memoir section, and then it'll distress me that if you have a memoir section, of course, do you put Hilary Mantel and Julian Barnes's memoirs in the memoir section? Mm. But then they're not with their other books in the fiction section.
Yeah.
But of course, in a bookshop, you have the option of double stocking, so you'd have it in both. But even for me, I think it's a bit excessive to get two copies of all the books I'm obsessed with, given that there are quite a lot. Yeah, and I do have lots of multiple copies. I mean, when I really like something, I find it incredibly difficult not to stockpile all the different editions. I don't really want to let any of them go.
A bit like, you know, if you're a One Direction fan and they do five versions of the CD with all their faces.
Very much like that. And it's also something I just really love book design. I'm not really attached to books as objects. Much as I love books, I wouldn't really spend money on them. You see, I always want to be able to read something in the bath, pretty much. So I don't want to...
Oh, so what are your worst kind of sort of abuses of books? Because I know that some people are very, very careful about them and other people are just like, no, I will read it.
Well,
and then...
yeah, I'm a terrible, terrible vandal. I read books in the bath, I turn over the pages, I write in them, I underline them, I litter them with post-it notes, I use them to write memos in, which is not a very... successful thing to do, because then I can't remember which book I wrote in the important list of the things that I now need to remember and can't. So I'm not a great respecter of the book as physical object. Having said all that, I love book design. So I really find it exciting when you see, you know, sometimes an advanced copy will have a plain jacket, and then you can kind of see the evolution of the design that goes along with the book, which in some ways can be really sort of linked to the success of that book.
Do you have any favourite books, that covers and designs?
Oh yeah, let's go into the other room. If we go and look at these, should we go and look at these new book
cases? Yes, let's look at these. So this is the bookcase that your uncle has just built.
Yeah, my uncle Paul has just built this for me. I think it's really beautiful. And you can smell the smell new wood. I just love the way, so it's got these poles down the middle, which are kind of working as bookends, which are quite good for sorting things out. So it might look like there is no rhyme and reason in any of this, but it's because I'm writing a book about books, and these are all to some extent involved.
So shall we talk about your book about books? Can you talk about it? Do you want to? Or is it...
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind. I'm writing it at the moment. It'll be out next October, and still haven't quite decided what it's called. I quite like talking to strangers about books.
Well,
do you think that's a nice title?
I think it's a lovely title. I want to say, you know, that's what we're doing now, but we're hardly strangers, so...
Well, no, but my favourite, the theme of my life is the truest thing probably I could say about myself is I like talking to strangers about books, no matter how that is, in bookshops, in libraries, strangers on trains, as a writer, at festivals. I just like talking to people about books. And, of course, when you talk to a stranger about books, they don't stay a stranger very long. Because that's the other thing I think is amazing about books, the power to connect people and sort of often you speed into intimacy with someone
really,
when you write
really
the same book.
And it's a sort of a guide. You can be very intimate but have a little bit of a remove because you're...
It's quite interesting. I've always thought it's quite a good shorthand as well. Like, so you might not want to... I don't know, you might not want to tell somebody loads of stuff about yourself, but if you both like the same novel, then it's like a nudge-nudge, wink-wink of people that understand things.
They're looking at your shelves now. I can see Brother of the More Famous Jack by Barbara Trepido and Fear of Flying by Erica Jong.
Yeah, I really love both of those. I do have three copies of The Pursuit of Love by Nancy Mitford because I just love this edition. It's
got... So this is the design that
you're... This is the design. So I love that they did this whole range. They repackaged all the backlist and I just thought they were so beautiful. So the cover art here is by Lourdes Sanchez. I just thought it was so beautiful. So I bought three copies. But The Pursuit of Love, I just think, is a really...
Can you read out the quote on the back? Because it's sort of... brings me into something I was going to ask you about, going back to Erica Jong.
Okay.
I love those lines.
Here, this one.
Yes.
"Obsessed with sex," said Jassy. "There's nobody so obsessed as you, Linda. Why, if I so much as look at a picture, you say I'm a Pygmalionist. In the end, we got far more information out of a book called Ducks and Duck Breeding. Ducks can only copulate," said Linda, after studying this for a while, "in running water. Good luck to them."
You know, Fear of Flying is... That's a sexy book, although lots of other stuff going on there. Certain very, 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 very popular and successful books have given sort of eroticism in literature a bit of a bad name. And I don't know whether Erica Jong, do you think she's still sort of beloved as ever? Is she a bit 70s? I love her.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit 70s, isn't it? I just...
Has that got the amazing 70s cover? Come over. Look at that. Ah!
Yeah,
it's got the female answer to Portnoy's complaint. That's very 70s, isn't it?
Very yellow,
wildly irreverent picture
funny.
Of her on the back.
I mean, I think a lot of the sex doesn't really work in it, does it? It's more like in pursuit of sex, she could have called it. So a lot of the sex doesn't work, and it's all about what it means. But it's also actually one of the reasons I do like the sex stuff, but I also like the therapy stuff. So because actually, if I remember rightly, the first line is utterly brilliant. Let's do the first line. "There are 117 psychoanalysts on the Pan Am flight to Vienna, and I'd been treated by at least six of them and married a seventh." I mean, that's how
it
to open a book, isn't
great.
It?
Great. Can you remember the first book that you read where a bit of you sort of knew you maybe shouldn't be reading it?
Yeah, I mean, because I was an extremely... a bit of a child prodigy and a big reader as a child, and had basically read everything that was on offer. So my mum was always very keen to me to read, but she had to write a letter to both the library in Snaith, which was the nearest library was in the village next to ours, and she had to write a letter to the library, and she also had to write a letter to the school librarian asking them to just let me get out what I wanted, because they were always trying to stop me getting stuff out because it wasn't appropriate. But I mean, I had then like read everything else, so I did go through a sort of a bodice ripper stage.
Ooh.
So literally the front of the covers were all sort of, you know,
the sort of boobs like those like Christmas puddings in
a
tub. I look like you're shoplifting them up a jumper.
But books are still fairly safe, aren't they? And I mean, I remember reading Lady Chatterley's Lover and not quite seeing what all the fuss was about. And,
were you disappointed? I think I was a bit.
I think I expected more in the... Well, mind you, I think that's the thing with D.H. Lawrence, isn't it? I remember doing... I can't remember now whether it was The Rainbow or Women in Love, but I remember reading that when I was about 16.
I think I was reading it in the first year of my A-levels and reading pages and pages of stuff, you know, light was exploding, flowers were bursting out into bloom, and I got to the end of it and wanted to say, like, so did they shag or not?
Well, I remember a bit in having an argument with people in an A-level group who were doing Emma, and I felt quite swizzed because... I think we were doing Doris Lessing a little bit, but I've read Emma. It's really easy. I can do it. But there's a bit where I think it might be possibly, wouldn't be Mr. Knightley, would it? Is it Frank Churchill? Someone is a bit sort of not safe in taxis, and there's like, he made love to her, or he tried to make love to her. And people said, there's sex in Emma. I don't think there is. And it was just the phrase of the day implying, and everybody being like, oh, it's, I had no idea, Jane Austen.
Yeah, I think I used to think Mansfield Park was quite boring. And then, again, somebody said to me, it's all about sex. And I read it again. And I thought, actually, yeah, I can get that. So, yes, Pride and Prejudice there.
What happened to Pride and Prejudice? It's got half its cover missing.
I know, why, you see, I've read it in the bath. Look at it. Look at it. Poor little creature.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I've probably read Pride and Prejudice, what? I mean, like, if I've read that 100 times, maybe. I might have read it 200 times. There are books which I just return to again and again and again. And I can't... The nice thing, in a way, about losing my memory, now that I'm in my 40s, my memory's much worse, is that when I reread books now, I get nice little surprises. Whereas I used to just
be... It brings back to Agatha Christie.
Yeah, well, it does, yeah. And then kind of like, oh, I can't remember that happened. But, I mean, I do know... All the good Agatha Christies, I know them almost off by heart, I think.
So you... worked in publishing for a long time, and is it right, were you a bookseller first?
Yeah, so bookselling, really. I worked for Waterstones for 10 years.
And in that time as a bookseller, how do you think that kind of impacted upon your relationship with books?
I think it was always... it's not much of an exaggeration. It's really not to say that books have saved my life again and again and again. And it's also not much of an exaggeration to say working in a bookshop saved my life. Because I really had... I mean, like, when I got a job in a bookshop, I really had... sort of quite monumentally screwed everything up. And then to work in the bookshop and to find there was something I could do, it was amazing. I felt so useless and low and crap and pathetic at everything. And to find that there was something I could really do, it was amazing. And that there was some... I remember thinking, like, oh, the only thing I could do is read faster than anyone else I've ever met. But actually that's quite good for some jobs. And then... And then also I realised that this sense of not being connected with the world, I was just kind of not hanging out with the right people. Because actually when I'm with readers, writers to a certain extent, but when I'm with readers, I feel completely connected. I mean, I'm with my tribe when I'm with readers, when I'm with book people.
Do you feel like a reader even before you're a writer?
I do, actually, and I still do. I'm writing about that a bit in the book's book. I still think it's my central identity, and probably at the end of my life, it's still like one of the main things I would say about myself. I don't think I'll ever not be a reader. Whereas I could not be a writer. It might be that the writing's quite a short period of life. I wouldn't be surprised by that. But I will always read.
I suppose as well, maybe, you know, one can be a writer and not write for, you know, a week or a month or a year or 10 years. But reading, you probably don't stop doing that for long. There's always something you reach for that's on the go.
That's true, yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I've assumed writing means... I mean, I'll always be a writer in that I will always be writing something down. Whether I'll always be a writer in that I'll always be successfully taming that into something linear that people might want to read and that might get published is a different thing. And then, of course, so in the same way, I'll always be reading books. And I would think as well, probably, I'd always be professionally involved in books. I can't think... Every so often, I think about what other jobs I might do, but I just don't... I don't know why I would get a job that didn't involve reading and books, really.
I think you can go two ways, can't you? Where if you're around books a lot and you love them and you read them and you're really, really immersed in them, you either sort of, you know, think any writing ambitions you have might be, my goodness, all of these people doing this and telling the stories, and I'm not sure and I'm quite overwhelmed by... the act of it, or you read things and you think, well, I could do that. And where do you think you fall? Does it depend on the day?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, I think the thing about being a professional reader is that the volume of reading... The thing is as well, I really like other people's books. I really do. So there are all sorts of ways in which I think you want to procrastinate about writing. I did a workshop just last weekend and was getting, you know, and this is people that haven't been published and they want to write, and I was asking them, Leah, what stops you? And it's all like family and whatever. But one of the big things that stops me is like, I really like other people's books. Does the world need a book from me? Maybe I would be better placed spending my time reading books and thinking about that and doing that sort of stuff. So it kind of, and I really just think that might be true. So in that sense, it sort of stops me. Someone, I can't remember who it is now.
Please, I'm going to say that. Please don't stop writing.
So kind. So it might be Elizabeth Jane Howard. I don't know. Some writer said that they started writing books because they'd read everything. So they started making up stories. And of course, that is to a particular era, isn't it?
Yeah.
You couldn't now, as a person engaged with the world, write books because you had nothing else to do, or that you didn't have, that there weren't other words to consume. So that could never happen now. The way that I'm so interested in series books, I'm really interested in women writing. I'm really interested in women like Agatha Christie and Georgia Heyer, who were really commercially successful, who wrote a book a year for lots of years, who often had, you know, either unhappy private lives or were sort of kind of either disrespected or secretive about their private lives. So I'm sort of interested in that. I'm really interested in the Second World War. I'm really interested in publishing in the Second World War. I'm interested about what happens to an industry when other things become more important. You know, so it may well be that all of that is leading towards something I want to
do. It does sound as though you're really like circling something, and it is a bit like a sort of War Games, Black Ops. I know nothing about how many things are, so you're about to hit on.
We'll be back to the books in a bit, but I'd like to talk about my steal of the week, a book so brilliant that it's worth its weight in diamonds, and buying it for the cover price is a bit like breaking the law. This week, it's a book that actually came out at the very start of 2018 in January. It is Feel Free, a collection of essays by the author and lecturer Zadie Smith. It's published by Hamish Hamilton. I find the world so overwhelming, and just when you think that you couldn't be more overwhelmed by it, it gets a bit worse. I'm on social media all the time. There's a lot I love about social media, but I struggle with the many, many hot takes, the opinions that haven't really been thought through or formed, and that everybody is in a real rush to say something very decisive and definitive. But I think the urge to speak perhaps overshadows the thoughtfulness and rationality that some people could do with using. So a couple of months ago, I bought this book. I'm a huge, huge fan of Zadie Smith's novels. I've binged on many podcasts and love to listen to her. And I think this is my favourite one of all of her books. It's very calm and very, very thoughtful. The very first essay, which is on the libraries that she's been to and loved in North London, you know, at no point does she really draw any conclusions or tell any of us what to think. It's a very subtle invitation to think about the big and small issues that that make up our lives. She's a really thoughtful book reviewer as well, and she is so very, very funny. The essay comparing Justin Bieber to the German philosopher Barber, I think it's Barber, she does it beautifully and skillfully. If you really need to take a deep breath and take a step back and you're as tired of hot takes as I am, this book is gentle and refreshing, but there's wisdom that will stay for ages. And it's really good value, because while I did buy it and binge it, I did keep picking up the essays again and thinking about all of the smart things that Zadie is saying. Now back to Kathy.
Do you, as a writer, are you ever aware that you're nicking someone else's voice? Are there any writers where you find yourself thinking in that rhythm or writing in that rhythm and catching yourself or not?
I'm really utterly, I'm terrified about plagiarism, especially as I get older. And also, especially, this is why I have to, I mean,
I've written Agatha Christie.
Well, I sort of forget stuff. Sometimes I read something I have written and can't really remember writing it. I'm really terrified I will plagiarise myself in that way. Like, because you're not allowed to do that, are you?
I catch people doing it all the time, and it's certain words and phrases. They're like, oh, that's a word they like to say, and I do it all the time too. I sort of notice it cropping up. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone likes repeating themselves, but at the same time, is it just like a signature, like an Andrew Lloyd Webber repeated riff?
Yeah. With all the books so far that I've written so much more that ended up in the book. So I've completely now lost the plot on
what I've written. But one of the reasons why I find the internet very scary, I've realised, and Twitter especially, is it because it sometimes happens to some people, I then become hyper-vigilant that it might happen to me. So you read about someone, I don't know, being a plagiarist or, you know, someone, again, suffering some sort of writerly industrial injury. And then I think it's going to happen to me and become very nervous and anxious. Well, I read You've Been Publicly Shamed by John Ronson, which is really good, and basically just made me terrified of the internet. So I've been anxious about it ever since. And You by Caroline Kepner. Have you read that?
Oh, I've not read that.
Oh, it's really funny. It's got a bookseller psychopath in it. So it's kind of like a sort of a funny thriller. But the character, who I think is called Joe, it's ages since I read it, uses social media to find out about his victims. And that, again, did make me feel hyper aware of how much we share without knowing we're doing it. Yep, Julian Barnes would be a life theme for me. Should we have a look at these? So I've got two. What have I got of these?
It's the multiple.
Yeah.
Different renderings of the parrot. It's like the parrot from different angles. There's the vintage one, parrot in profile, and then I don't know what that's a slightly different vintage edition.
Yeah. So I think they did an anniversary edition of this. The original one. Yeah. So this is the original Picador. I say original. A History of the World in 10½ Chapters, Julian Barnes. So this will be something that I've owned for years and years and years, this book. Mind you, maybe not, 'cause it's got someone else's writing in it. Because the thing is, I do give books away, and I like to give books away, so I don't tend to... You know, when I say I've been loving this book since I was 12, usually it's not the same edition, because I've lost it, given it away, it's fallen apart. I think I probably quite like that.
There's the Pursuit of Love as bought as an ungiven gift. What do you think is your most given away or gifted book?
I really like Mary Wesley, actually. And again, that's quite...
It's quite sexy.
Well, it is, actually, but also quite...
I'm obsessed.
Safe.
More shame than me than you, I think.
You know, when someone just needs a really good read, you don't want to give them anything that's too terrible. So I like my favourite Mary Wesley. Oh, look, this has been mine for ages, because I've written The Bell and Crown in it.
Is that the pub?
That's the pub. So that will have been when I lived there, which was from when I was 17 to my early 20s, and the front cover's fallen off. So, yeah, this will be it. Original one.
Gosh, yeah, that makes your copy of Pride and Prejudice look
pristine.
Some sort of showroom copy.
Yeah, but I love this one. So this is, again, I really like novels where old people are remembering being young people, and then preferably when they were young, getting up to all sorts of shenanigans, or indeed getting up to shenanigans as old people. I also enjoy that. So I quite often give people Not That Sort of Girl, which is why I've got an extra copy of that. I think at one point I bought sort of 4 or 5 of that and would give it to anybody who felt like they were just in need of some sort of...
A kind of novel cure.
Yeah. And Heartburn by Nora Ephron. Again, you don't ever want to say to someone, sorry, your marriage is falling apart, but this will cheer you up. But having said that, I do like to say quite often about how the whole Nora Ephron's whole thing about everything is copy and, you know, be the heroine of your life and not the victim. I do think that one of the best things about writing is that whatever happens to you, from the kind of the big to the small in terms of bad stuff, once you start feeling curious about how you could write about it, how you could explain it to someone else, then that something of the terror does shift a bit, I think.
The Nora Ephron piece of writing that I return to the most, that I love the most, is an essay she wrote called The Star Is Born. I don't know if you've come across it. I think it's in Scribble Scribble, and it's about ambition and envy and how she's up for this TV presenting job, and she has got this rival, and as I think we've all got this person where it's always between you and them, a bit like if you were an actor and the person's kind of similar to you.
Yeah, which is back to why books are just great in general, because every time you think you're feeling something unique and you are the awful one, or it's your unique awful experience, if you turn to literature, you'll find someone.
Do you know the Emily of New Moon books, Ellen Montgomery?
Yes, I do.
And there's a bit where she said something like, the wonderful thing and the awful thing about writing is nothing is ever as magnificent as it is or as awful as it is when you write it down. Yes. It sits in your head.
I think that's in general true quite a lot. And I think when you think back at a time, it was never as good as you thought it was, and then it was never as bad as you thought it was. So, yeah, I'm not as keen on them as the Anne of Green Gables books. I'm completely obsessed with Anne of Green Gables. I've been writing a lot about that lately, and about see, it's very interesting how this stuff comes together, Anne of Green Gables, Pride and Prejudice, Fear of Flying. But I was thinking about how you kind of grow up wanting to be a particular person, or being told that you should be a difficult person. One of the things I love about Pride and Prejudice is, of course, Lydia Bennet, the younger sort of slaggy sister, we're really encouraged to disapprove of her. But I mean, I think I've got a pretty strong Lydia Bennet streak. And it's that whole thing that you're always trying to be Elizabeth or even the saintly Jane. And it's a bit the same in, so in Anne of Green Gables, can't remember which book, I think it's Anne of Avonlea or Anne of the Island, and there's a classmate called Ruby Gillis. And again, Ruby Gillis has always been like, she's always had an eye for the boys. And as far, I mean, it is Anne of Green Gables. I mean, there's no sex. There's not a hint of sex or anything like that. But as far as there is...
Well, I'm sure some people have a fetish of having a slate smashed over their
head. Well, quite, yeah. But in as far as there is sex, Ruby Gillis is like... massively up for it. And then, of course, she has to get consumption. She's blonde and ringletty, sort of red cheeks, red lips, even before she gets consumption. She's very beautiful. She's the most beautiful corpse Mrs. Linda's ever seen, I think. But of course, but that's the thing. She it's one of those things where you think, oh, you would like to have sex, so therefore you have to die. You have to be killed off. You know, but that's
Thomas
always
Hardy
quite
country,
isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, you look a bit like you're on a promise. Let's throw you off a mountain.
Sort of moral lessons in novels, isn't it? Like What Katie Did, you know, be a bit disobedient, end up being disabled for a really long time because that's what you deserve for not doing what you're told.
I feel quite sad because I loved that book so much. Mm. And rereading, have you read Lucy Mangan's book about childhood reading?
Yes.
And Lucy Mangan's sort of rereading that and thinking about, you know, the moral of What Katie Did and the way it's sort of rewarding women for being quiet and still and stoic and not doing like, oh yeah, that's not the best, is it?
No, but I also...
But I love the school one.
Yeah.
With Clover.
I love it. And the getting wrongly punished because the teacher thinks they're the ones that are sending the letters to the boys.
Yes!
And they're not. And being wrongly punished. I do also think, though, you can sort of simultaneously read stuff with a modern eye and think how interesting, but you can also still just love it for itself. So I'm not going to allow Ruby Gillis having to die because she fancied a shag, put me off Anne of Green Gables forever, I don't think. But it's one of the reasons why it's so interesting, isn't it? What I've become, so I've just got hold of Ellen Montgomery's journals. Ooh. Because again, I'm really interested to see what, like where the shadow side is in herself. Because of course, it's always you've got to remember as well that these women were writing into an environment where they were very limited in what they could say.
Yes, and they had to, because so many of them, I suppose, were doing it because they had to make some dollar and they had to have a sort of commercial eye on what was going to.
Yeah, but she didn't have a great life. And, well, I mean, in some ways she did, I suppose, but she had a very interesting and much more troubled personal life than. Though in some ways her story does sort of tally a bit with Anne's in some ways. But I just find that I find that endlessly fascinating. What ends up on the page and how it ends up on the page. So potentially the same person could write a diary, not for public consumption. Mm. Though of course I'm reading it now. Could write novels. Could be written about all this stuff about them. And of course this is becoming a writer myself. I then become really preoccupied with other people's children because of course I'm more preoccupied with the well-being of my child than I am with the well-being of myself. Mm. So.
Who are your favourite and least favourite children in books? Who would you adopt and who would you return to the orphanage?
Well, again, having my own child has sort of informed... That sounds very Oni, doesn't it? Having my own child. Sharing my life with a small creature who once was inside me has given me a real liking for finding him in literature. So in Anne of Green Gables, he's Davy Keith, so he's the very unruly and boisterous six-year-old boy who says, like, I'm not bread and butter hungry, I'm plum cake hungry.
Yes.
And Georgia Heyer, actually, there's got a lot of very nicely done children. And there's Felix in Frederica, again, a technology-obsessed child. General, like, nice stuff with heroines quite often have slightly unwise younger brothers.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So we are in Kathy's kitchen. I see wetsuits on the bookshelf and exciting books. There are library books,
which I really love. I love getting books from the library. Sometimes I order stuff because someone's told me about it, like Patrick Gale recommended I read A History of Reading, ooh, which I hadn't read before.
That is vast, and that's Alberto Manguel.
Yes, I haven't looked at it yet, but I was talking to Patrick about reading, and he suggested this, and I haven't read it yet, but it says the history of reading does not exist, for it cannot be written, only imagined. But anyway, so I'll get that out from
there. Shouldn't really be a book after that, should there? They'd be like, nope, that's
yeah,
it.
That's it.
We solved it.
Heroines of SOE, completely obsessed with the Second World War, Britain's secret woman in France.
Oh, that looks great.
So this was great. I finished this now.
So when you go to the library, do you sort of have books in mind that you're looking for, or are you quite browsy and will you grab things that intrigue you?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. I order stuff from them, so if I think of something I want, I quite often see if the library's got it, then you can order it and then it gets sent to them from all over Cornwall. I quite like it as well in this modern world. I could, of course, probably immediately get an e-book, but instead I wait to see whether it will surface from the central stack. I kind of almost quite enjoy in that way that there is this delay and that I don't know if I'll get what I want. So there's this The Clocks by Agatha Christie. I know it's not a particularly good Christie, but I when my son asked me the day what it was about, because we talk about Agatha Christie a lot, because I'm obsessed with her, I couldn't quite remember the plot. So I thought, well, I'll have to read it just so I can update myself. I mean, one of the reasons actually why I really like reading crime is that I think it has a social commentary. You know, there's a social history built into it. Yeah, so this is 1963. So it will interest me to reread this, partly just to see what it's about. And also, again, thinking 1963, you know, Sylvia Plath died in 1963. What else was happening in 1963?
Yeah, that's,
so I think reading
Beatles records. And
yeah, Larkin thinking that sex was invented. So we'll have to see what
ooh,
The Clocks has got to say about it. This is just a pile of stuff. Matt and I are reading. We read a bit of Biggles, Diary of a Wimpy Kid He Likes, and he adores these treehouse books.
I have a 13-story treehouse. They're amazing, because I don't think my son would mind me saying that he hasn't always, you know, he likes being read too, and he's very interested in stories, but he struggled with reading quite a lot. But these, they're sort of a bit graphic novel-y. They're very funny, so he likes getting the jokes out of them and then telling the jokes. They have a really zany sense of humour, and he just loves these. And I would say, I mean, lots of things have helped him read, including actually audio versions of Harry Potter and reading Harry Potter, which he also likes to do. So loads of things have been helpful, but these 13-story treehouse books by Andy Griffiths and Terry Denton have been amazing. So people quite often want to know what you can give a child who's not that keen on reading, but the thing is they've just been complete pleasure, partly I think because of the great cartoons. And
brilliant. I was thinking it's so interesting that children's books, I think such a lot of them are really, really funny, and then obviously there are, you know, funny novels and funny books for adults, but they seem to be perhaps a lot less commercially successful and a lot less highly regarded, when I think writing a joke is one of the hardest things in the world.
Yeah, funny books don't tend to do well, but I think also when you try to think about funny novels, it can be tricky. There's not loads, and there's not many that sort of work and stand the test of time. Tell you what I was thinking about the other day was Kill Your Friends by John Niven, which is
unbearably funny apart from everything else. And I was thinking about it actually because I was thinking about Ambition, and there's a great line in it about how Jerry Halliwell wants so much to succeed that she would swim through shark infested spunk. And I thought, actually, that's quite a good way to, it's like that fin, the sharky in there, the idea of the fin being up, that's a very good way of describing someone who's very ambitious, isn't it? Now you've just reminded me of Funny Books, and I thought, yes, that's Funny Books. So I'll probably at some point now have to reread that novel because it's kind of started to dig into my head a bit.
Well, I just saw it in a charity shop, and everyone sort of thinks of it as a bit, you know, this kind of big, big romantic novel, but I really loved One Day, but I think I loved it the most for the jokes. And there's that bit about Ian, the stand-up comedian, Emma, as a line where it's something like, in, you know, the years and years that they'd been going out, Ian had only ever really made Emma laugh once, and that was when he fell down the stairs.
That is very good. But David Nichols is very funny, you see. So again, he seems to be funny almost with whatever he does.
I love Sophie Kinsella. And obviously, she doesn't need my help. She does very, very well. But I think she is one of the best comic writers alive, and I think there's a lot of snobbery about the way she's packaged and sold, but
there's a real thing when something becomes successful, people then want to think that it's crap precisely because of it's successful. So I would also put Harry Potter in that category, and Bridget Jones's Diary, again another magnificent comic creation.
I think Bridget Jones's Diary is magnificent. That's the book I probably reread the most and know nearly off by heart.
Pretty much every year, at the beginning of the year, I read Adrian Mole and Bridget Jones.
I brought these down because I think what I read before bed is quite interesting. Oh, as in, yes, that I can't read.
Brilliant. So yeah, this is your by the bed books. The Daily Stoic. I don't know. That looks great. Well, that looks like a book I need in my life.
The basic rule for bedtime reading is I can't read new things and I can't read anything that's too exciting because I just won't go to sleep. And as I get older, I can't cope with not sleeping. So I just don't read new fiction before bed anymore. So I read, I'll read diaries. Quite often I've got a writer's diary on the go. So I was reading, or, you know, Virginia Woolf's letters or something like that. I'll read that sort of non-fiction. But I also have a real passion for things. So this is called The Assassin's Cloak, an anthology of the world's greatest diarists. I love this.
Ooh.
See, this is my second copy of this because I had a hardback. It was published years ago, and I gave that away to someone, can't remember who. So then, and then I just thought I wouldn't have it for a bit. But then I just thought, no, I can't live without it. So I bought it again secondhand. But basically, every day of the year, there's a sort of a selection of diary anthologies. Virginia Woolf. So 1935. Yesterday I saw the kingfisher again on the river. It flies across and across, very near the surface. It has a bright orange chocolate underside. And it is a tropical bird sitting weighted on the bank. I've also seen a stoat, brown with a white-tipped tail.
That's a good entry.
So it's kind of, and I just, something very soothing. And again, it's that whole thing, life goes on. Oh, Vera Brittain, there's quite a lot of her. Quite often I read someone in here and then I go off and read the whole of their diaries or the whole of their memoir or whatever it is. And I'm not allowed technology in my bedroom because I'm not allowed to then think, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I should Google and find out at what point, you know, Christopher Isherwood did this, because of course then you're into a whole lot.
One eye open and you've ordered 10 diaries. Be here tomorrow.
Yes. So, and I like, yeah, so the Daily Stoic, similar thing. There's a different thing per, I quite often have some of this, a different entry per day. I love stuff basically with an entry per day. Let's see if we have better luck with this. Life isn't a dance. The art of living is more like wrestling than dancing, because an artful life requires being prepared to meet and withstand sudden and unexpected attacks. It's quite nice, isn't it? Well done, Marcus Aurelius. Love Marcus Aurelius. I like the random nature of it, but also I like the imposed structure. Like, I just would have a pile of books.
There's something about, with that kind of book, the choice being taken out of your hands. All you've got to do is, it's this day.
Yeah, exactly. I could come down and look at my enormous poetry shelf and choose something from it, but then I do find actually that I can get really overwhelmed with choice, even in my own house with my own books. And I can sometimes, when I'm looking for something to read in the bath, I'll just sort of like stand and stare at the bookcases, and then I'll think, you know, it's probably been 8 or 9 minutes and all I've done is I can't decide, you know.
So this is way better than spending 20 minutes sort of gazing at Netflix going no. And I do find, especially on social media, there's lots of quite, I find it very frustrating, the
a bit of superiority in the way people read. And I think, and maybe, you know, this has always, always been the case. But sometimes I do think, bloody hell, people are a bit performative about the way they read. And I'm totally guilty of it. And I'll, you know, be like, I like this, I think it's good.
Well, I mean, I suppose, when thinking about other people, then, like, I mean, I like doing actual face-to-face stuff with people. So I really love doing reading and writing stuff in prisons. And part of the reason I really like it, to be honest, is that there is no performative element to it. People literally can't communicate with the outside world if they wanted to. And nor is it performative for me. I'm telling you about it now. But I don't... Even when I did social media, it was never appropriate, really, to say I'm going to... You know, quite a lot... The guidance tends to tell you, unless it's a public event, not to say, like, I'm going to this prison and blah, blah, blah.
I said the worm would scrub the sign of your thumbs up.
Right? Yeah, exactly. All that sort of thing. So, So that is about doing actual, really real work with often people that are quite damaged, have very bad experience of education, and just trying to shift the dial for them for a bit. So I really love that. One of the things about working with emerging readers is they have a real thing of thinking that if they don't like something, it's their fault. So, and I, you know, because my dad couldn't read and write till he was in my 30s, till he was in his 30s, and then didn't read for pleasure until he retired. And then I helped him learn to read for pleasure, and now he does. And that's like an amazing, amazing, amazing thing. But again, he's still quite fragile in his... I'm careful about what I recommend to him, because if he didn't like it, he would think like he was too stupid to understand it or something. So
what sort of stuff does he like? What have you got him into?
Well, I mean, he really likes old stuff now. One of his favourite books is Any Human Heart by William Boyd, which is one of my favourite novels. He really loved Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. Is there another word in there? The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry? Anyway, the book about Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. He really loved that. And that was longlisted for the Booker Prize that year. And he'd already read it. And I said, well, Dad, you know, not many people read books before they're longlisted for the Booker Prize. So he felt really pleased with that. But he reads a lot. And my parents tend to read the same things. He adores Jojo Moyes. So they read lots of stuff quite widely. Not a bit of light thrillers, but nothing too violent. Including me. I think there's a whole really struggling with reading any kind of psychological crime or thriller at the moment, because I just think it's too violent. They seem to have really upped the ante on the violence in the books, which I think is a shame, really. But hence one of the reasons why I'm just rereading Agatha Christie all the time. Then there's something about crime novels where they are satisfying, as you know, so they're soothing because it's slightly a cross between doing a crossword puzzle, a logic problem, that kind of thing.
I was just thinking about jigsaws and that, like, sort of the, you know, fitting things tessellating in a way.
Yeah, so that's what I like. That's why I like to read that sort of book. So, of course, I then don't want it to be... I basically don't like really being frightened, because enough frightens me. So I don't want in my leisure time to be like intentionally scared by books or TV. But it's I do read sad things, and I will read sad things on purpose to make me cry, because I will know I need a good cry, and I think of it like bleeding the radiator. So I know I need to cry every so often. So I read a sad thing to make me feel that way.
What are the books that make you cry?
Well, again, I mean, quite a lot of the kids' stuff, partly because, again, it doesn't tend to disturb so much. So, you know, the Anne books, the Anne of Green Gables books, first few, and Little Women, Good Wives, that kind of thing. So I often do turn to a children's classic. I sob over Harry Potter as well. I love Harry Potter. And they're so... I think they're all about death and depression, basically. And the thing is, I read them all to my son before he could read, but now he's reading them for himself. So we just continually have this, have this relationship with them. And every time I read it, I find some other metaphor or some other meaning. So I think they're brilliant, but also they make me cry. So the other day I was reading to him from, it's The Order of the Phoenix, and Molly Weasley is getting rid of the Boggart, and you have to... Basically, a boggart will assume the shape of the thing you most fear, and she sees the boggart... I'll be off again. She sees the boggart take the shape of her children. And Harry's watching this. And there's something so incredible and sophisticated. And, of course, I haven't spotted this before in any of my multiple readings of it. But Harry is watching this woman dealing with this fear that her children will die, this quite real fear that her children will die. And I'm reading it aloud to Matt, and I just kind of... It is like... But Mummy, you've read it loads of times. Oh. You didn't cry before. I said, I've just realised how sad it is. And it's so unbelievably sad. But then also I was reading my friend Tom Palmer, who's a lovely kids author. He's written a book called Armistice Runner. And it's one of those nice time slips. So there's a girl in the modern day doing a fell run. And then there's also a story about her great-grandfather running down the trenches in the First World War, set in Cumbria. And you kind of know terrible things are going to happen. I was reading it aloud to Matt, but I just kept losing it and crying. And he said, like, voice is wobbling again, Mummy. I said, I know, I'm very sad. But again, I think that's part of how, I don't know, maybe he will be, a very poorly adjusted grown-up because I used to cry at him all the time. But I don't, it's that whole thing, isn't it? How you let, whether you let your children see your sadness or whatever. But for me, I think to show him that I am moved by books and I'm moved by sadness, I think that's probably okay.
And the books are moving and it is absolutely okay and more than okay to respond to it. In those days. Have you read Dear Mrs. Budge?
I have read Dear Mrs. Budge.
I loved it and I had a real weep. And I was on a sun lounger and I had to blow my nose on a towel.
I love the bit in the Café de Paris. And I just thought it was also such a nice idea because I also really like women's magazines as a thing of, as a, like a little time travelling.
Yes.
A little way of time travel if you look at a magazine of the period.
Industries in the war. That, you know, you think how important were they or not, and this idea that it's very important sort of to keep up morale, and it's not quite propaganda, but it kind of is, isn't it? You know, everything's fine and we're going to get Fritz when no one's really allowed to write about how frightened they are.
I really loved Lissa Evans's novel, Their Finest Hour and a Half.
You know, I long to read that, and it's so good. Why I haven't.
It's so good, and but it's similar sort of... it's Second World War, and it's about... propaganda, and I really loved it. I've been wanting to reread that lately, so I get this thing into my head that I want to reread something, and then at some point I'll track it down.
How much time do you think needs to elapse, or does it depend on the book? Do you try to give it at least a year, or
no? I mean, sometimes I finish something and then read it again immediately. Yeah, but I think it's partly I do read very fast, and I just can't cope with being in a open narrative. So ideally, I don't really start reading something unless I know I can read it in one bolt. Because it just distresses. I don't know how people watch soap operas, because they don't end. I've never been able to cope with it, because from the moment the goes to the next programme, those people are rampaging around in my head because they're not finished. So, and that's actually why writing fiction is unbelievably uncomfortable for me. I really love talking about writing, and I was doing this workshop and I said, you know, the things what most writers' minds are doing, certainly mine, is there's a little voice saying, God, this is crap, this is probably the worst novel that's been written in the whole history of the world. How embarrassing for your poor agent and editor that they thought you could write fiction when you clearly can't. But then equally there's another little voice that pipes up every so often saying, like, oh, that looks quite nice, you know what, I think we might be a bit of a genius.
I'd like to say a big thank you to our brilliant guest, Kathy. Her books, The Last Act of Love and A Manual for Heartache, are published by Picador and available everywhere. I couldn't recommend them harder. A Manual for Heartache, especially, is the sort of book that everybody needs to have in their bedside table to refer to during urgent moments. And it's a great book to give to anyone who needs a bit of emotional support during a difficult time. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to everybody who's been supporting the podcast on social media. It is so lovely to hear from you all. For information about the show, to find the books we've talked about, please go to acast.com/booked. And to get in touch with any queries about the show, please email whybooked@gmail.com. It's why the letter booked@gmail.com. I am on Twitter @notrollergirl and on Instagram @thedaisyb. That's B like the insect. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do rate, review and subscribe. It helps other listeners find the show and it's really great to hear your feedback. Thanks so much for listening. Do keep reading and remember, never be ashamed of anything that's on your shelves.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.